You are listening 90.7 FM Radio Community Columbia Clunky Clomp Clomp.
This is Sarah Kendall. You are listening to WGXE 90.7 FM Community Radio in New York's Greene and Columbia counties.
We are about to hear a conversation that I had with Aaron Smith. He is one of the organizers behind something called the Rolling Jubilee, launched last Thursday by an organization called Strike Debt, which is an offshoot of Occupy Wall Street. This is what they're doing. They're raising money to buy distressed debt from financial firms, just like debt collectors do, often for pennies on the dollar, and then erasing the debt so that borrowers don't have to repay. So they buy the debt like debt collectors, then instead of hounding you, they erase your debt. You get a letter in the mail that says your debt has been erased. They are buying up debt in order to, quote, liberate debtors at random through a campaign of mutual support, goodwill, and collective refusal, and have raised to date over $350,000 to abolish over $7 million of debt. Organizers have dubbed the effort the People's Bailout. We are joined now by Aaron Smith, one of the organizers of the Rolling Jubilee.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great. I'm so glad that you could join us today, because I swear I have had like at least a dozen conversations about this over the past few days, and most of the things that we say end in question marks. I think people have a lot of questions. So I'm wondering, first, for someone who hasn't heard of this effort yet, could you explain to somebody what it is and how it works?
Sure, right. So the Rolling Jubilee is a project of Strike Debt, which, as you said, is an offshoot of Occupy Wall Street. It's made of people who sort of met each other through Occupy and have been having a conversation, or actually several different conversations for about a year now, centered around debt. So what we noticed is that all these people from all these different backgrounds came to the park or came to our assemblies in Washington Square Park, and they had very different social backgrounds and very different social interests, but a lot of them had in common the fact that they were very severely in debt. And this is borne out by the numbers. 1 in 7 Americans are being pursued by a debt collector, and something like 2 or 3 times that amount is very close to being in default themselves within 1 or 2 payments. You know, one bad event, such as a medical accident or losing a job, could plunge people into the same situation where they're being hounded by debt collectors. So we found that debt was really a common thread. We say that it's the tie that binds 99%. And we started thinking about ways to sort of make that commonality a little bit more tangible and a little bit more explicit. So we started out by having these debt assemblies where people would show up and just tell their stories. And so people who had housing debt would find commonality with people who had medical debt or educational debt or something like that, and really help sort of build a sense that there's a common interest class among debtors. Later on, we were approached by a man named Thomas Gilkey, who had seized on an idea that's been kind of kicking around activist circles for a few years. And the idea is really simple. So it turns out that banks and large lenders are required by law to sell off debt that's in non-payment after about 180 days. It depends on the state, it depends on the circumstances and the type of debt, but that's roughly the ballpark. And so because they're required by law to sell this stuff off, they take a tax write-off. And because they take a tax write-off, they can sell it for extremely low prices. And so they have regular agreements with these large firms called debt buyers, which will just take all of the debt that a particular credit card company or hospital or whatever has to offload. And they get really great volume deals. And so those debt buyers then repackage these loans and sell them off to debt collectors. So this is where we come in. So because the debt buyers pay just pennies on the dollar, we're able to buy the debt for just a 5 cents on the dollar, maybe even less, depending on the type of debt it is. And then instead of trying to collect on the debt, going to people's houses and threatening them, as debt collectors do, we just erase it. We take it off their credit report, we send them a certified letter, and we say, thank you, have a nice day.
How do you actually purchase the debt? Do you walk into the Bank of America and say, I want to buy a bundle of unpaid debt? How does that happen?
No, yeah, so I want to be clear. We're not actually dealing directly with the banks here. This is a common concern that we hear, that, you know, we're just giving money back to the people who are causing the problem in the first place. So the banks are required to sell this debt by law. They're already selling it off to a secondary market. And honestly, at the volume that we're dealing in, we're not even a drop in the ocean. So the secondary debt market is tens of billions, maybe even over $100 billion a year, no early notes for sure. And we're dealing with, at the moment, according to our counter, about $360,000. So we'd have to go 3,000-4,000 times larger than we are now in order to really start making waves. But the way we do it is we're working with some of the debt buyers, some sympathetic debt buyers who we found via personal contacts. and wish to remain anonymous because they don't want to be blacklisted in the industry. But they are sympathetic to our cause because they're humans. And one of them said, you know, I have kids who are going to college and are going to be drowning in debt their whole lives. This needs to change. And it's true, it needs to change, and I think that's pretty widely recognized. You know, we're getting good press in places like Forbes and Fortune magazine. I think everyone realizes that the system we have now as far as debt is completely unsustainable, and this is one way for people to do it without having to wait for the government to take any kind of action.
Okay, I have a couple more questions that just have to deal with some of the kind of nitty-gritties of this. Can you speak at all to who's, like, this? I think this is the most common question I've heard is, like, whose debt will be forgiven, what kinds of debt, and do you know?
Yeah, so whose debt will be forgiven is somewhat random. So because of the way the market works, we are buying bundles of debt that were already created by the debt collectors, so the debt buyers. And we can focus somewhat broadly on broad geographical areas, you know, depending on where the debt buyers are, and types of debt, like medical debt, for instance. And that's what we're doing first. We're focusing on medical debt for a number of reasons, chief among them being that we feel that one of the most salient ways to make the case that we're in a debt finance system where debt is just financing people's basic needs, right? And so when we buy people's medical debt, which is what we're doing, we're shining a light on the fact that these prices have been driven up by debt, and such that people can't really pay these sorts of things anymore. More than half of the debt collection accounts in the country are medical debts. And they're often just accidents, and most often people who already have insurance. So that's an interesting point to make, is when Governor Romney introduced statewide health insurance in Massachusetts, it did not decrease the percentage of medical bankruptcies in the state. Hmm. And Obamacare, which is modeled very, very much on Romneycare, is not likely to do the same. It's not likely to address this problem either. And the reason is that these are sort of punctuated events. These are things like cancer treatments or hospice care or major surgeries that are causing all this debt. And insurance is just not built to handle that. So we really need to start treating the medical system as a public good or a good in common rather than as a profit-making tool. And that's the only way we're going to be able to get out of this sort of debt-financed spiraling increase in prices.
You know, one of the things that I think is really interesting about the Jubilee is that it's, you know, as much about bringing attention and awareness and educating us around the debt system that we have in here. And even in just the past couple of days, in trying to poke around on the internet, I have learned more about what's going on than in the past as a pretty concerned citizen. But I'm curious, you mentioned this yourself, and one of the most common things I've heard as a criticism is that people say, you know, oh, no, even if they were to raise an enormous amount of money to buy this much distressed debt, the project can only be trivial relative to the scale of the problem. So can you clarify maybe for us what the objectives of the Jubilee are, maybe what you would recognize as impact or as success?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So, again, what we're dealing with here is a problem that's just vastly beyond the scale that any crowdsourced funding operation is going to be able to deal with. But there's two goals. One, we are helping people, and I don't think anyone should diminish that. You know, we bought $100,000 in medical debt early last week before the telethon, and now we're going to buy many, many millions of dollars and more, and we are helping about 80 families with $100,000 that we bought last week. So you can only imagine that we're going to help maybe over 1,000, 2,000 families during the course of this project, given the money that we have now. So no one should diminish that. That's a real tangible benefit for thousands of people. But more importantly, it's as you said that we've started this conversation, right? So I hear from my friends who span the political spectrum that they've been having conversations about debt that they've never had before, and really starting to understand the debt industry and really starting to ask questions like why it is the case that banks and debt collectors can purchase this debt for pennies on the dollar, but people are not allowed to. And the story behind that is simply that banks are afraid of moral hazard. They're afraid of what would happen if people realize that this debt doesn't actually mean all that much to the banks. But in scale, it clearly does, right? And so what we're starting to see is people understanding that they have some leverage. And now once we as a class, as a group of people across the country, understand that we have leverage against these financial institutions, we can start to innovate ways to use that leverage. And that's what the Debt Resistance Organizing Manual or Operations Manual and the Debt Resistance Organizing Kit, which are available on strikedebt.org, start to talk about. We're having a national visioning session on January 21st. It's going to be held in New York City and satellite locations around the country. And we're going to bring people together from all different stripes and sort of have conversations about what it is we can do with all this newfound power that we have.
Could you talk a little bit more about the Debt Resistors Operations Manual, what that is?
Yeah, so the Debt Resistors Operations Manual is a very serious 130-page book that we wrote this summer, sort of outlining tactics for people who are in default or are nearing it. So one of the things that from which this conversation came is that it started last year with the Occupy Student Debt Campaign, which was trying to build a petition to get people to sign up and agree to all simultaneously default on their loans, their student loans, when a million people signed a petition. They only got about 10,000 people to sign the petition, and they realized that it was sort of pointless to sort of try and draw people out and have them agree to perform a debt strike for a few reasons. One, there's a lot of shame around debt. People don't like to talk about their debt in public, and we've addressed that with the Why Strike Debt Tumblr and our debt assemblies. Two, there's already 5 million people in default on their student loans already, and millions more in default on all other kinds of loans. So we started to think of these people as sort of the invisible army of defaulters, and we thought, well, what if we could mobilize these people who are already performing a sort of debt resistance because they can't pay or they won't pay for whatever reason? So we wrote the Debt Resistors Operations Manual. It's a set of very practical day-to-day tips for people how to respond to debt collectors, how to catch them when they do illegal things, how to dispute illegal items on your credit report. So something like 2/3 of credit reports have errors that are really hampering people's ability to get a job or get an apartment or something like that. And just sort of day-to-day tactics to resist debt in your everyday life. And these are applicable to everybody, not just people who are already in default. So we built this up, this manual, and we're starting to send it out now to the people who are helping with Jubilee.
You know, I was just looking at the manual today and picked out a couple of excerpts like this. There's this phrase, collection agencies are counting on you to not do your homework. They are counting on you to be an easy mark and to be overwhelmed by Kafkaesque bureaucracy, harassment, and shame. And then the next like subtitle in there is, what is a collection agency and why are they calling you? And I found myself thinking like, oh my gosh, this is so useful. It goes from, it is no longer rhetorical, that document that you guys have put together. It's pretty it's pretty comprehensive and seems like a real tool.
Yeah. I wanted to point out, though, that, so I think this is one reason why we focused on medical debt in particular, because huge amounts of these collection accounts, that are, again, medical debts are the majority of collection accounts out there, huge amount of these collection accounts might be illegitimate and impossible to verify without violating health insurance privacy rights. So in the same way that mortgage lenders are famously lost track of paperwork and titles when they were selling off these mortgage-backed securities, debt buyers and collectors are often not in possession of the legally required proof that entitles them to collect on the loan. So in the Debt Resistors Operations Manual, you'll see sample letters that will actually allow you to call them out on that. And more often than not, we think you'll find that these collectors will have to drop the case entirely. And we could really start making targeted strikes against collectors en masse, even without buying people's debt with the Jubilee.
Wow. For people just tuning in, we are talking to Aaron Smith. He is one of the organizers behind the Rolling Jubilee, a project just launched by an organization called Strike Debt, an offshoot of Occupy Wall Street. They are raising money to buy distressed debt from financial firms, just like debt collectors do, and then abolishing the debt so that borrowers don't have to repay. They are buying up debt in order to, quote, liberate debtors at random through a campaign of mutual support, goodwill, and collective refusal. Organizers have dubbed the effort the People's Bailout, and they have raised to date over $350,000 since Thursday. The Rolling Jubilee website talks a little bit about student debt and what is slightly different about student debt. It talks about the federal guarantors around student debt and why there isn't a secondary market. Can you explain that for me? I'm not sure I fully understand.
Yeah, so the deal with student debt is this. There's over $1 trillion of student debt in this country. It's larger than auto loans. It's larger than credit card debt. And part of the reason that it's skyrocketed so much in the last couple of decades is because it has extraordinary government protections. So the government guarantees a huge percentage of student loans, an increasingly large percentage of student loans. And this makes it such that debt holders are not really all that interested in selling off the loans because they are guaranteed a steady stream of income from it. You know, you're in a situation right now where 80,000 people in this country are having their Social Security wages garnished because they are not in full payment on their student loans. And that number is only going to increase as the generation that's been paying $30,000, $40,000 a year for their tuition starts to age. So that's why we can't buy student loans right now. There are other things that one can do. Even though you can't discharge student loans in bankruptcy, we can start to target particular lenders who are holding a lot of student loans. And that's a conversation that we're going to continue having over the next couple of months leading up to the summit. And you might see some interesting announcements about that in the new year.
I have another question. This is another thing that just keeps cropping up, so I'm wondering if you can clarify it for me. That there's a lot of conversation online about the tax risks of what's going on, and there's a couple of different points being made. Some people are talking about how forgiveness of debt is generally considered taxable income to the borrower. Others have said that this kind of debt forgiveness is understood as a gift in this context. So can you help us understand the tax risks or what's going on there?
Yeah, so I am not a tax lawyer myself, but we are working with tax lawyers who feel very strongly about our case, and we have a recorded phone call with the IRS that suggests that we're in a good position. But I think the more interesting question is that think about what it means that forgiven debt is now considered income. What it means is that the IRS considers that income would have come to them anyway. That means that the person who is owed the debt would have worked harder in order to pay back that debt. And now that the debt is gone, the IRS doesn't consider that income to be lost. And we think it's really interesting. That's sort of like a Milton Friedman understanding of employment and wages that's embedded at the heart of the tax code. And you see a lot of the people who are criticizing us, especially people on the left, not really digging into that analysis and just sort of getting into the bed with the IRS and some very libertarian ideologies of the tax code. And I think that's it's telling, and it's a little unnerving that people aren't thinking a little bit more deeply about that. If it comes to the point that we have that kind of conversation with the IRS, our lawyers are extremely happy to have it. We don't think it'll get that far at all. But more importantly, we think that it will advance the conversation about, you know, how far the debt industry is really willing to go to extract every last dime from people.
It is really, really interesting. and I actually do, I do think that there's been this, like, just in the past few days, there's been this, and I've heard just on the street and in my own conversations, an introduction of some new terminology. Even just the phrase debt resistance is not something I had ever said or heard before. I'm wondering if you could talk another phrase like that is mutual aid. The idea of mutual aid versus charity. Could you talk a little bit about that and what that means?
Yeah, thanks. This is an excellent point. So we say time and again, both with the Occupy Sandy efforts, which are sort of cleaning up after the hurricane here in various areas of New York City, and with the Rolling Jubilee, that this is not charity. It's mutual aid. And what we mean when we say that is we feel that the people that we're helping, we're not sort of just giving them something, as though we're the savior and they're the saved. What we're doing is we're helping out people who are very much on the front lines of the battle that we're all fighting. Whether you are in default on your debt or not, whether you have debt or not, though the odds are that most people listening to this program have an enormous amount of debt, you are touched by debt. The prices for basic goods in this country have been driven up by debt dramatically over the last several decades. Municipalities are drowning in debt that's been created by the fact that our basic needs are debt financed. So, you know, it's been said that the new American dream is getting out of debt, and I think that rings true. It's not a new idea. Even in Death of a Salesman, it's the same as scene where Lily Lohman is complaining about his refrigerator, which he purchased on layaway, and it just broke. And he's saying, you know, you just, as soon as you're done paying for it, it starts to break. And that really seems to be the case with a lot of the things that we have in this country. It's no longer the case that debt is a tool to help you buy things that you can't afford, but it's a tool to make you keep paying for things that you need, from education to housing to healthcare and even food.
Hmm. Aaron, could you talk a little bit about the Jubilee? What is it, what a Jubilee is, and where that comes from?
Yeah, so I'm not a biblical scholar, so you're going to have to excuse my very rough recall. But it's an old Hebrew tradition where every 49th year there would be a freeing of the slave and a cancellation of all debts. And there's very good reasons for this from a societal stability standpoint. Here in David Graeber's book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, which despite its imposing title is actually a really breezy read, and I highly recommend it. He describes how this debt cancellation phenomenon developed over the course of early civilization, even before the Hebrews actually. as a way of preventing rebellions, because when debts existed, they would naturally create inequities, and those inequities would accrue over time such that people would own generations of other people's families. In fact, we had slavery as part of our transactional system, and that would lead to uprisings pretty regularly. And so those in charge realized that in order to have stability, they needed to sort of cancel all these debts and have a regular holiday for which to do this. And so that was the notion of the Jubilee. You can find reference in the Bible.
You mentioned a little bit before some of the connections between the Occupy Sandy relief efforts, which have just gotten so much attention recently, and this effort. And I was just reading about how Goldman Sachs is partnering with New York City to offer low interest loans, and it rang like it struck me that there was probably more intersections and overlaps between these two these two sort of simultaneous efforts. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The connection is very literal. I mean, half of our organizers, when Sandy hit, just plunged themselves into it. a little bit of trouble for the planning of the telethon, but we got through it. So you'll notice we were collecting, actually, at one point, the first response of the banks. People would get emails from their credit card companies saying, oh, we want to help you so much. You know, we heard you've been hit by Sandy. We're going to up your credit limit. So that's their idea of help, is, you know, to get you deeper and deeper into debt. And seeing the response as well, they've showed up with these 6% interest loans, which is above the market rate for any kind of collateralized loan. And this is what they do. They want to finance everything from debt. But it gets even more insidious than that, because what you're seeing now is the early wave of opportunistic disaster capitalists. So I'm sure most of you listeners have read Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, and we're seeing it play out right now in Far Rockaway and Staten Island. The exploitative developers and speculators are showing up. They're offering loans at very high interest, or they're offering to buy away properties very cheaply and sweep people out and really reshape the communities. And so what you're seeing with Sandy is something called rebuild and recover, where people are sticking around. So again, this is the aspect where it's mutual aid and not charity. Occupy Sandy people are sticking around. And they're not just dropping off diapers and groceries, but they're helping people rebuild with sustainable materials, and rebuild so that they retain local control and resist developers and resist these sorts of speculators that are looking to completely remake the community. You know, they've all had these projects on their shelf for a long time. I'm sure you've heard of the projects to sort of completely reshape Coney Island, which continue to get defeated by community pressure. They're seeing this as an opportunity. And we're seeing it as an opportunity to resist and to build bonds within a community.
For people just tuning in, we are talking to Aaron Smith. He is one of the organizers behind the Rolling Jubilee. If you don't know what it is, you can check it out online at rollingjubilee.org. It is one of the newest projects launched by Occupy Wall Street. They are buying and erasing people's debt. Okay, I'm almost ready to let you go, but I have a couple more questions. This is something else that I've heard a few people bring up, and I'm just curious about how you might respond to it. There's the idea that this is a project that in some ways is participating in this kind of debt game, that by purchasing the debt, and I might be making too much of a leap here, but I also heard Amy Goodman the other day brought up a question that had been asked by another journalist, asking, if I'm recalling right, that if the Jubilee ever got off the ground in a big way, that what if credit companies were compelled to make more predatory loans and enabling debt sellers to charge the Jubilee more and more. I'm hoping this makes sense, but could you help me tease out the distinction between resistance, debt resistance, and then this kind of participation in the system?
Yeah, so I think it's a valid sort of thought experiment to conduct, but we need to really get a sense of the scale here. So as I said, the debt market is tens of billions, possibly more than $100 billion a year. We're dealing in the hundreds of thousands right now. And that's not simply a matter of us sort of getting more popular or getting more news coverage. It's 1,000 times larger than we are right now. That's a qualitative, a categorical difference in what we are right now. So the danger of us sort of, you know, dramatically affecting the debt market is it's impossible. I'll go ahead and say it. What we are doing, I mean, in terms of monetary terms, in terms of how people treat debt, we hope we have an enormous impact, and we hope we have a lasting impact. But you know, let's like run the thought experiment through. Let's say that, you know, we have thousands of chapters that are each raising hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we are actually materially affecting the debt market. What would be the result of that? Yeah, we would raise the price of the severely distressed debt that we're interested in. But what would that mean is that it would raise the cost of doing business for debt collectors. It would lower their profit margins. It would probably knock a significant number of them out of business, because the reality of the matter is they're not going to collect on a lot of these. The reason that they can pay 5 cents is because they expect to get 6 cents, 7 cents, 8 cents, maybe even 10 cents on the dollar, right? So if we abolish, you know, debt that's at 5 cents on the dollar, and we drive up the price to 6 or 7 cents, we're going to make it unprofitable for them to do a lot of business. And I consider that a positive outcome.
Hmm. Aaron, I want to thank you so, so much for joining us today. Could you talk for someone listening who's interested in either participating, contributing, or learning more, or maybe finding the operations manual we talked about? Can you talk about sort of where people can go from here?
Yeah, so you should check us out at strikedebt.org. That's all one word, strikedebt.org. We have an open house in New York City on December 1st. It's going to be at Judson Memorial Church. If you check back on the website and our Twitter feed at strikedebt, and also our Facebook page, which is strike-debt, you'll find more information about that. And there'll be a national, or actually a global visioning session on January 21st, where we're going to link together all the strike debt chapters that are sprouting up across the nation and in different countries. There's one in the UK and one in Toronto. And just sort of strategize about how to create targeted debt strikes around the world.
I just remembered that I had one more question. I don't know if this is, if there's anything to this or not, but I was thinking about the use of the word abolish when you talk about buying the debt. And then I've noticed in some places you're not saying forgiving debt, but abolishing debt. And I'm wondering if that's a meaningful choice, if there's some context there.
Yeah, thank you. That's exactly right. We are not forgiving debtors, because forgiving implies that they did something wrong. What we're doing is erasing debt, because we consider that debt to be a wrong that's been placed on all of us. And we're calling it, some people like to use the word abolish. I'm a little less dramatic. I used to like to use the word erase. But either one is much more apt than forgive.
Although, you know what it made me think about? It made me think about the prison abolition folks who really purposefully frame their fight in really dramatic terms to shift the conversation. And it struck me how much the Rolling Jubilee work seems to be about as much about how this conversation is being framed. And like your response to my question about the tax risks did just kind of, that framing of it kind of flipped me upside down a little bit. In that sense, maybe the word abolish has some resonance there too.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, so much of this is about getting people to shift their frame and shift the way that they think about debt. You know, it's not a moral obligation. The banks and the 1% treat those debts as just business decisions. You know, I interviewed Neil Borofsky, who is the Inspector General for TARP, the bailout program, for my radio show, and he said flat out that he thinks more consumers should start treating debt as a business decision, not a moral obligation. There's no reason that people should consider these debts to be permanent if they can't pay them.
Hmm. Maybe just for fun, Aaron, because I know you have a radio show at WBAI. Could you tell us what your radio show is?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So I'm one of the co-hosts of Occupy Wall Street Radio. It airs every day at 6:30 p.m. on WBAI, and it's archived at archive.wbai.org for 90 days.
Well, thank you again for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much. I'm happy to help.